Session number 9722, Morris Levine, part one.
Where were you born, Mr. Levine?
I was born in the Cheetham district of Manchester in 1907.
What did your father do for a living?
My father at that time was a tailor's presser. That is, he worked for these small tailors, you know, bespoke orders. And he would press the jackets.
Was he self-employed or was he an employee?
No, he was employed by the master, as they called him.
And what was your education?
My education was elementary and ceased at the age of 14. My formal education, at least.
Were your family poor or well off?
I came from a large family. There were six brothers and five girls. And we were working class, but I think because of the largeness of the family and people being at work, I can truthfully say we were not deprived, you know, and in any way.
So how did you come to be interested in politics?
Well, when I was about 20 years of age, I emigrated to Australia. I had a brother working there, and he nominated me, which meant that I think the government paid something towards your fare or something like that. And I went out to Australia in 1928. I was then working in the clothing trade as a garment cutter, which incidentally I continued throughout my working life in the clothing trade, in manufacture.
So how did your interest
now
in
then,
politics develop?
I was already moving towards socialist ideas when I was living in Manchester as a young man, but the Communist Party and the Young Communist League were very active in the Cheetham district, and because at that time there was a large number of Jewish working class people living in that area, and the first generation of these immigrant Jews, young people, they seemed to gravitate, at least a section of them, gravitated towards the Communist Party and the Young Communist League. So I knew about that, but I was never a member. I was never asked. I'm sure if I had been asked at one of the outdoor meetings they used to hold, I would have joined the Young Communist League or the Communist Party. Now, when I got to Australia in 1928, the following year, 1929, saw what's called the Wall Street crash. And this had its almost immediate impact in Australia, because the Australian economy at that time was geared to primary products. That was the export of wheat and wool. And the market fell, of course, and I was out of work in 1930. And there were other people out of work too. But it was very difficult for English migrants like myself, because there was no form of social insurance. If you're out of work, you've got nothing at all. And for an Australian whose roots were there and lived with his family, it wasn't too bad. But for an English migrant, it was very difficult indeed. And they were creating some sort of trouble in the city of Melbourne where I lived, in the sense that I can always remember seeing two young men chained to the railings in the centre of Melbourne with a large placard. And they were offering their services for anyone for £10 a year and their keep, working for them, whatever it was, whether it was in the house or in the garden or so on. Now, about that time, the authorities rounded up all the English migrants who were floating around the city, homeless and so on, because they had no money, couldn't pay rent or have a room. And they rounded them up and took them to a First World War camp, army camp, about 30 miles outside Melbourne, called Broadmeadows. I can always remember this very clearly, because one day I was walking along the principal street in Melbourne, and there was a demonstration a march, walking down the road. I couldn't say how many, but it was quite a lot of young men who had come from this camp. And the aim was to enter the state parliament and draw attention to their plight. And they were shouting slogans. And they eventually got to the state parliament and brought proceedings to a close. Now, what happened that day had a big influence on me, you see. Now, I was also out to work, but I just had a few pounds saved up, and I wasn't destitute yet. But also at that period, there was only one organisation that was helping destitute people, and that was the Salvation Army. Now, they gave what was called a sustenance ticket, and you had to go to their offices, and they didn't give you any money. They gave you a sustenance ticket to the value of 5 shilling, which you changed at a grocery store for food. And that was enough money in those days to, you know, give you the bare essentials. Now, I wouldn't go because I was already, you know, I thought it was charity and that sort of thing, and a handout, which I didn't like. And I went up country and they're looking for work to the North Victoria, to the fruit growing areas or whatever. And I found temporary work. And then a friend I left behind in Melbourne told me that the factory where I'd worked at, which incidentally was the first rubber factory in Australia that made rubber tyres and all kinds of rubber articles, tennis balls and so on, and they also made waterproof clothing, of which I was employed in there. And they'd laid me off. I was the last comer there, and they laid me off when things got slack. And my friend wrote to me saying that he'd seen the manager, and he says there was work for me for about another 5 or 6 weeks, you know, it was sort of seasonal. And I remember going back. But then after then I was out of work again, and eventually in 1931 I tried to get back to England by masquerading as a passenger on one of the P&O boats to get back to England. But my scheme, I was finally apprehended. I had a cabin. I didn't hide, I wasn't a stowaway. I tried to bluff my way as a passenger, but it was very difficult, and I was apprehended, and I finished up in prison in Adelaide when I was charged with an offence. And during that time, this friend of mine who had written to me when I was up country, he'd gone back home. He had relatives in Australia or France, something like that, who paid for him to go back home. And when he got back home to Manchester, he went to see my parents and told them that Morris was starving and all that business. And when I was actually in prison, this letter came to a former address where I lived in Melbourne, which they couldn't deliver. It was left at the post office, but I got to know about it. And sending my fare out to come back to England, which was a lot of money. I mean, it was only 40-odd pounds, but it was a lot of money for working class people. And I didn't like to accept this, but I was still out of work and I wouldn't take any charity from that. And I thought I'd go back to England, and I returned to England in 1931, and immediately I joined the Communist Party.
So you'd not joined a political organisation before that?
No.
Why did you choose the Communist Party rather than another left-wing party?
Well, the Communist Party in those days, 1931, was in such marked contrast to the outlook of the Labour Party, the official Labour Party, that, of course, I think around about that time you had the national government and you had the defection of the leaders of the Labour movement, people like Ramsay MacDonald, Snowden, J.H. Thomas, one or two others, who left the Labour Party to join with Baldwin in creating what was called the national government. And one felt that the reformist line of the Labour Party would get the working people or nowhere. And of course one must have been influenced by the Russian Revolution, because after all it wasn't such a terribly long time since this had occurred.
Which particular Communist Party branch did you join?
I joined the Cheetham Communist Party, Cheetham branch of the Communist Party.
Was it a very strong organisation?
Yes, it was quite a good organisation, but the Young Communist League was stronger still. They had a social club in Cheetham, and the majority of their members must have been Jewish, I think, because it was a big Jewish working class area. And that was a really... I mean, they had about 200 members in this club called the Challenge Club. Challenge was the name of their weekly paper, and it was called the Challenge Club. And not everybody who came to the club were members of the YCL, but they were under influence of the YCL. And as a matter of fact, it was from that club, that Challenge Club, which was responsible for what became known as the mass trespass, which took place on Kinder Scout in 1932.
Did you take part in that?
I took part in that, yes.
Were you a member of the YCL or the CP?
No, I was a member of the CP.
Was the CP weaker than the YCL then?
No, I wouldn't say that at all. It was very strong in Cheetham, and I don't know about elsewhere, but don't think it was in such large numbers in other parts of Manchester. But most young people who were politically minded at that time, come to my experience, gravitated towards the Young Communist League.
Which particular individuals in the Cheetham branch stand out in your memory?
Well, there was one young fellow named Michael Jenkins. He was always a sort of leading person, and later on, as he got older, became a full-time worker for the Communist Party. And then there was a family called Ainley. Three brothers, all very intelligent. The eldest was a man named Ben, who was a schoolmaster at some grammar school. And there was Teddy, who became a secretary of the Scientific Workers' Trade Union during the last war, or something like that. He was that secretary of that. And then there was the youngest of the three was David. Now, he'd been to grammar school. And they were a big influence, these three brothers, in the sense that they took Marxist classes. Oh, and by the way, also at that time, about 1932, I used to attend a Marxist class taken by a man named Robin Page Arnott, who was the historian of the Miners' Federation of Great Britain. And he was up in Manchester. He was an Oxbridge graduate, I think, along with his wife, who was named Olive Budden, who was from a middle-class background.
Olive who?
Budden. B-U-D-D-E-N. From a similar background, too. And whenever Page Arnott couldn't attend to take this class, she would deputise. And this was held in the basement of a Swiss, or at least a continental restaurant in the centre of Manchester, where we used to take a room. And I believe that I got a fairly good grounding in Marxist theory from listening to Page Arnott. Mm.
What were the campaigns that you engaged in that stuck out in your memory?
The most important, of course, was the agitation and struggle against the mostly fascists, where Manchester was one of the chief centres, apart from London. And I can remember there was a big strike in East Manchester at a wireworks called Richard Johnson and Nephew, very large wireworks. And by the way, I think there used to be a Dean of Canterbury, Hewlett Johnson. I think he was connected with that firm or something like that. And through his family, of course. And it was a time of motion study strike. They'd brought in American consultants to speed up production, and there was a strike. Now, blacklegs were brought in to this strike somewhere in Openshaw, East Manchester. And I was asked by the organiser, the secretary organiser of the Communist Party in Manchester, to go to this factory, and when they cease work, to follow the blacklegs and find out where they were living. And I did follow them. They got on a bus, a double-decker bus, and I discreetly sat behind them. And they finally arrived in Higher Broughton, and they went to what was the barracks of the Black Shirts in Manchester. They were, this was in Northumberland Street, Higher Broughton, which is part of Salford. And they were young men who had been unemployed and brought from different parts of the country. They lived at this large double, well, it was two houses or something, great big houses. And they lived there, it was their barracks. And they were supplying the blackleg labour for this strike. And I was able to give this information. It's printed in the Daily Worker at that time. And
Were you in any violent demonstrations against
the Well, yes. The Black Shirts used to walk from the centre of Manchester, say they'd been somewhere at a meeting or, I mean, a closed meeting of their own people. And they'd walk through Strange Ways, which was a Jewish area. It's near Strange Ways prison. It's not very far from the centre of Manchester. I mean, you're at the centre of Manchester, you go along Duty Street, or you're in Strange Ways within 5 minutes or less. And they would go to this barracks up in, they'd have to walk along this very, very new road. And they used to frequent a cafe, which was just there on the edge of the centre of the city. And they would meet there and gather there. And from there, then they'd walk home. And quite often, we would sort of tangle with them as they were walking up this road going to their headquarters. And they had a lot of tough fellas with them, boxers, you know. There was one famous one named Moran, I think, heavily scarred, and I remember him. And I got near him and I took a swipe at him, he took a swipe at me. It's a good job we both missed, because he would have knocked me out, no doubt about that. And they weren't looking for an actual physical fight, because they would have been outnumbered, but they were provocative. And they used to do this nearly every night, march through this area to their place. Yes.
Were you ever injured yourself?
No, but I had friends who were. I remember a friend of mine named Wilfred Winnick, Wilfie, we call him Wilfred, whose brother, by the way, was a famous band leader of the 30s named Maurice Winnick. He used to play at the Dorchester. And he went to a meeting at Bellevue, the big King's Hall, which holds about 7,000 people. And he got up to ask a question, and heckling, you know, must have been a bit provocative. And of course, if you behave like that at one of their rallies, you immediately pounce upon, I mean, all these fellas carried truncheons, you know, they were dressed in their black uniforms, broad leather belt, and a little truncheon at the back. And they'd haul you out of your seat, as they did with this chappie. And then in the corridor away from the main hall, there'd be a gauntlet, you'd have to run the gauntlet or you'd get pummeled. And they actually lifted him up and threw him bodily into the street. And he was rather badly injured, was Wilfie.
Did you see that?
No, I didn't see it, but this actually took place. I wasn't there. This actually took place because I knew him, a friend of mine, and I saw him bruised afterwards and that sort of thing. And he was a bit of a boxer. He used to box for the YMCA amateur boxing team. So he fancied his chance in a fight. And I can remember also a woman named Evelyn Taylor, who was a member of the YCL, who incidentally, if I may say so now, became the wife of Jack Jones from the Transport and General Workers Union. This was at the Free Trade Hall, and Mosley was speaking, and she got up, she was in the balcony. And I was there, I saw it, and my girl at the time, who's my wife now, she was there too. We were all in the party of the YCL. Now she got up to ask a question, and then she wasn't satisfied. And if they saw you were not satisfied and you're still on your feet, she was ejected brutally, no question about that, and thrown out. That was Evelyn. And they didn't differentiate between the sexes.
Now, coming on to Spain, can you tell me what your memories are of the Franco coup in the summer of 1936, how you received the news of it?
Well, you must remember I was already a political animal, and I was naturally very interested in what was taking place in Europe, in Germany, in Italy, and also other countries in Europe like Yugoslavia, Hungary, Bulgaria, were all semi-fascist countries, Romania, all semi-fascist countries. The only really democratic countries were the Scandinavian ones, and probably Czechoslovakia, and England and France. And that was the lot. Because the emergence of Hitler in Germany had tremendous influence on some of the other smaller countries in Europe, and had bigger influence here in this country. And we were aware of this. And one felt this was growing. I mean, you didn't think of going to Spain when the actual coup commenced. But by October, really before the international brigades were formed, you knew there were groups of people from Europe, mostly political exiles and Frenchmen, who had already gone over the frontier and were taking part in the militias, mostly on the Aragon front, which was really not much of a front at the time. It was quiet. But you knew this was taking place. And there was also a small group of English people. In fact, the first British casualty was a woman who was living in Barcelona at the time. She was an artist named Felicia Brown, who went to the front with a militia unit in the July, August days, and lost her life. Now, by October, I had the idea that it was possible to go to Spain, that they would welcome people coming from abroad. And I went to see the Communist Party in Manchester and asked, could I be sent to Spain? Because I was a Communist Party member, and one felt, you know, you couldn't go off on your own, you were disciplined and that sort of thing, and you would ask permission. And they said, no, there's no point in, because things were looking very black in October. But he says, look, Morris, he says, Harry Pollitt's coming to Manchester next week. Maybe you can have a word with him. And he did come to Manchester following me, and I went to see him. The offices of the Communist Party then were in Fountain Street in the centre of the city. And I told him I wanted to go to Spain along with my friend Bill Benson. And he said, no, it's not worth it. He says, the war will be over in 6 weeks' time, because by that time, the Franco forces had taken Toledo, which was not very far from Madrid, and it looked as though the whole thing would collapse. He says, there's no point. Now, at about that time, two blokes did go to Spain from the Manchester area. One was a chap named Clem Beckett, who was a well-known dirt track star in the northwest of England, who had his own garage, and he went along with a man named Arnold Jeans. Now, he was a very interesting character, was Jeans. People in the Communist Party thought he was an agent or something like that, because he spoke with a foreign accent, and he was a white Russian. His family had fought against the Reds in the Russian Civil War and then settled in Riga. And his father was a professor at a university there. And he had come to England at Arnold and had worked at Rothamsted Experimental Station. He was something to do a research work in agriculture. And eventually he found his way to Manchester, where he represented a left-wing film unit. I think it was called Plato Films at that time. Now, this man was a linguist. He knew about five or six languages, and had actually, because I researched that man some years ago and got into touch with his widow, and he had been at some time a tutor to the Bowes Lyons family in foreign languages. See? And I've had that material, but I've been very stupid over years. I don't know if I'm too good-natured or what, but I've given a lot of stuff away to people. And I've had all the evidence. And I repeat it In the article I wrote for The Guardian and in my booklet about this chappie Beanie, he is held in high esteem in the book which Esmond Romilly wrote called Boadilla. He was the commander of that little British unit of about 20 or 22 people, and he lost his life at Boadilla del Monte in about November, December 1936. That was Arnold Jeans. Of course, Jeans wasn't his proper name. I don't know what he was. But he was a very fine fellow and a great leader of men. Romilly speaks very highly of him in this book. And he's been sort of, no one knows about him and so on. But I knew him in Manchester. Now, these two blokes went, and then I raised with Pollock. I said, look, you've let these two fellows go. See? Ah, he says, what's his name's a machine gunner, has been in the Territorials. That was Clem Beckett, and the other man had military experience. He says, but you've never been, you don't, it's no point in you going, Morris. So that was that. Now then, after November the 7th, when the international brigades had already been formed and took part in the defence of Madrid, a whole new picture emerged. I was then asked by the Communist Party in Manchester in about the second week of November, do I still want to go to Spain? I says, yes. I was working, by the way. And by that time, I knew of four other young men from Manchester, members of the YCL, Jewish boys from Cheetham, who also wanted to go, and there was my pal Bill Benson. No, there was three. I'm sorry, there was three. And there were six of us now. That was a boy from Didsbury, named, only about 20, named Eddie Swindles. There was Bill Benson. There was Ralph Cantor, who lost his life. There was George Westfield, who lost his life. And, of course, Eddie Swindles lost his life. So out of the first eight who left Manchester, five were killed. So to give you some indication of the intensity of the struggle there in the early days, and no doubt later on too. And you can tell the newness of the operation, because when we saw a chap named Robson, who was the responsible in London, you had to see, he was given the task. He'd been a sergeant in the First World War, member of the Communist Party, and because he'd been in the army, he was reckoned to be, well, he knew what was what, and we had to see him, and he sent us on our way to Paris. Now, you can tell of the newness of the operation is that we were not given any credentials whatsoever. When we got to Paris and went to the Place de Combat in the 7th District at an address which was a Maison, the syndicate of the Metal Workers Union, and we saw a Spaniard there. He had a little office, and when he learned we had no papers, he wouldn't accept us. He just says, you know, no papers, no go. Because I think all along, in the very early days in particular, they were very much afraid of infiltrators, provocateurs, fascists, you know, and of course they did come into Spain, into the international brigades, no question about it. And that's one of the supposed great criticism of André Marty, who was the principal of the base Albacete, of being paranoid about